This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFK. If you're not already a member, consider joining with us and keep free speech alive.
And we'll see you next week for Voices from the Front Lines, Tuesday at 4. Tell your folk, get them out. Up next is Daily Briefing with Ian Masters, and I will see you next Tuesday at 4. It's a date.
Hi, this is Kelly Madison, inviting you to join us Tuesday nights at 7 p.m. on Beautiful Struggle. A just world is possible, and each week we bring you people who intend to make it real.
We have the ability in this country to produce for the world, but yet still hunger and poverty is continuously increasing. So, you know, I just want to be buried with my boots on if I didn't have to, you know.
I really believe that we have the power at this very moment to be free, but we give our power to our oppressors.
Every individual must tune into their individual responsibility to simply be and live up to themselves.
Let's come together, all the left, all the progressives, every revolutionary, all this whole class. Let's see what we can do to make sure that now we're taking it to another level.
Now let us begin. Now let us rededicate ourselves to the long and bitter but beautiful struggle for a new world.
Join the dialogue Tuesday nights at 7 p.m. on Beautiful Struggle.
Hi, I'm Maria Armudian, host of The Insiders, offering insight into today's most pressing issues. Tune in on Thursday at 4 p.m. when we speak with human rights lawyer and professor David Cole about his new book, The Torture Memos. That's Thursday at 4 p.m. on The Insiders.
Hi, I'm Danny Glover, and you're listening to Fiercely Independent KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and worldwide at kpfk.org. Radio powered by the people.
This is the Daily Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and discuss the banking reform bill announced today by Chairman Senator Dodd. And we will look further at government SACs, the intertwining coterie of financial and policy deciders who control our economy and look increasingly like the post-communist Russia, where state and private power are not only interdependent but blurred. We'll be joined by Janine Wydell, who's a professor at George Mason University School of Public Policy and a senior research fellow at the New America Foundation. She has a new book, Shadow Elite, How the World's New Power Brokers Undermine Democracy, Government, and the Free Market. And then we'll examine the money behind the health care votes in Congress and the forthcoming votes in the Senate. We'll be joined by David Leventhal, who's a communications director for the Nonpartisan Center for Responsive Politics, who have published a list of senators and congressmen and how much money they have received from healthcare insurance companies and Big Pharma, etc. And then we'll look into the political future of Sarah Palin with Richard Kim, the senior editor of The Nation, and he's written a new book, Going Rouge, Sarah Palin and American Nightmare. Stay tuned. And welcome to the Daily Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'm joined by Dr. Janine Wydell, who is a professor at George Mason University School of Public Policy and a senior research fellow at the New American Foundation. She is the author of a new book to be published in December, The Shadow Elite, How the World's New Power Brokers Undermine Democracy, Government, and the Free Market. And she has a new piece out in Salon.com entitled Wall Street's Bailout Gives Me Deja Vu. And just before we get to the Wall Street bailout, Janine, and the connections to what's going on in Russia, which of course this is the 20th anniversary of the Berlin Wall coming down. Today, Chairman Dodd of the Senate Banking Committee, himself a politician in trouble for having gotten a sweetheart loan from Countrywide Savings. He's obviously trying to, he's fighting for his political survival, and I'm sure having seen John Corzine go down in New Jersey and Mayor Bloomberg barely squeak by in New York, he understands that Wall Street billionaires aren't the flavor of the week. They're going to combine some of the bank regulators and abolish two of them, the Office of Thrift Supervision and the Office of the Control of the Currency. They're going to create a single new bank regulator, the Financial Institutions Regulatory Administration, called FIRA. They're also going to give the Congress more power to choose directors of the Fed. But what's your sense of this? Is this closing the barn door after the horse has bolted, given that these people took the global economy to the brink of collapse? Now they've been rescued by the taxpayer. They're better off than ever. They've transferred all this enormous amount of public debt into private debt, and they've left the taxpayer with these toxic assets. They're bigger, stronger, and too bigger to fail now, and they're laughing all the way to the bank.
Right, it sure sounds like that, doesn't it? And what we're seeing, as you've alluded to, is a lot of centralization and centers of power like we've probably never seen before, where so much power and influence and billions of dollars are concentrated in the hands of just a few people. What has been absolutely striking to me is the parallel between this interlocking handful of Wall Street government policy deciders who are coincide in a sense at the highest echelons of power, and are symbolized in the term government Sachs. Government Sachs, a play on the term, obviously, on the word Goldman Sachs. And what I find so interesting, having spent so many years in Eastern Europe studying communism as it really worked, and then the aftermath of communism, and looking at how power and influence was wielded after the collapse of an authoritarian communist system, and what you had were intertwined networks of business and state players who concentrated information unto themselves, whose loyalty was to themselves rather than to the public, and rather to the institutions that they were working for, whether it was the government or the businesses, the shareholders, boards of directors. And so you had power concentrated in this very few, among a very small group through the 90s in some of the post-communist countries especially. And it seems so eerily, what we're seeing today in the aftermath of the financial crisis seems to me so eerily reminiscent of these kinds of maneuverings that one saw in Eastern Europe, which are largely beyond the reach of traditional monitors, largely beyond the reach of public input. Gone are the messy disagreements and competing interests of really what is as democracy. It's hard to get more efficient than having two former Goldman Sachs executives like Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson and his assistant Neil Kashkari hand $700 billion in taxpayer money to errant financial firms, including, as we know, a hefty chunk to Goldman Sachs. So I'm seeing this parallel in terms of the players, and also in terms of the structures that are being created, this new financial architecture and new relationships, new intertwining of bureaucracy and market. Of course, we saw and we see this in extreme form in the aftermath of communism and in a place like Russia, a perfect example of this intertwining of bureaucracy and market in Russia is Gazprom, which is, of course, the natural gas conglomerate that was created out of the Soviet gas ministry in the late 80s. And staffed by communists turned capitalists, of course. And even though it was nominally privatized in the 1990s, the Russian government holds a controlling stake, and it's run today by Putin cronies. And this seems quite, again, eerily similar to what's going on in the United States. Bailouts, as we know, have made the U.S. government a huge shareholder in the financial firms AIG and Citi, and as well as to car manufacturers, General Motors and Chrysler.
Well, let's get a sense though of how much the similarities between what happened when communism fell in the Soviet Union, now Russia, when all of those public companies controlled by the Communist Party then were privatized. So all of these public assets went into private hands. And we've had a sort of form of privatization and deregulation here in the United States, particularly under the Bush-Cheney regime, where they tried to transfer as much public money as they could into private hands, a process called privatization. So this is separate from what you're talking about. You're seeing a kind of an incipient state and private monopoly being formed here.
Right. Well, I mean, there are actually a number of different processes going on in the Soviet Union, in the former Soviet Union, and countries of the East Bloc, as well as in the United States. In the former countries of the former Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc, of course, when a command system collapses and there's nothing there to take its place, and also the push is to privatize, the ideological push from the international financial institutions and the government is to privatize state-owned resources, then of course, the nexus, the play of activity, is where state and private come together. I mean, that's where everyone who is connected and is educated and sometimes ethically challenged comes to the state to get what they can out of it. So those were extreme cases, and of course there's a huge amount of diversity within them, and some countries privatized much more than others. I mean, Russia and Ukraine are sort of classic cases where they create, oligarchies were created virtually overnight, with the state being and the country being looted, and these sort of state private corporations were new forms were created, and people became instant a very few became instant billionaires. In the United States, there are several processes that have been going on since the Clinton era. There's been a decided reconfiguring of the balance between state and private interests, and a hollowing out of the regulatory and monitoring functions of the state. And a major contributor to those developments is the contracting out of government work to private companies. And as I said, that's a long-term trend in American government, but it's been especially pronounced in the past 15 years. So that today, 3/4 of people who are working for the federal government are actually working for private contractors. 3/4. And it's not just that contractors are doing things like food service and gardening and photocopying and that sort of thing. They are actually performing many government functions, what are classified as government functions. That has become routine, especially in the past number of years, so that contractors, choose and oversee other contractors. They draft official documents. They run intelligence operations. As we know, there are many more contractors in Iraq and in Iraq than there are military. Well, many more. I mean, the statistics that I saw, 20,000 more contractors in Iraq than there are actually military personnel.
So I understand how much public monies have been transferred into private hands, and people who can just hang up a shingle, fire the government workers, hire low-paying workers, and make a huge profit. That's what happened at Walter Reed, for example. So this is an ongoing trend that was accelerated during the Bush era. But trying to Janine Waddell, trying to get a sense of how our oligarchs are similar to the Russian oligarchs. Because the Russian oligarchs sprung up overnight. Our oligarchs have been around for a long time, and arguably we're heading into, if we're not already a plutocracy, we're certainly on the way to becoming a plutocracy. We can go back to Teddy Roosevelt's day. The oligarchs were really in control, and then he was the accidental president. He rolled them back a little bit. He created antitrust, etc. So can you give us a sense of the analogy? You know, obviously our oligarchs have been around for a long time. And how have they suddenly gotten more entrenched and more powerful in the modern era, in the recent decade?
Yeah. Well, that's a very complicated question. Of course, one thing that I would say about the difference between the power elite of today and that of 50 years ago is that today's what I call shadow elite are more global. They're much more peripatetic. They play multiple and mutually reinforcing, overlapping roles very often. We've gone beyond what's called the revolving door to what has now been called the evolving door, where the door has disappeared in many cases. People are on both sides of it, so there doesn't even need to be a door. A number of developments have enabled this. I mean, one development is certainly this intensified contracting out of the state. That's happened intensified very significantly in the past number of years, so that so much more of governing is actually outside formal government. We also have the rising number and influence of quasi-government advisory boards. We've got generally a drift of governmental legitimacy and expertise and information to private sector individuals, private sector partners. And then after in the wake of the financial crisis, we have, power that was already becoming concentrated has become even more concentrated. And, as you mentioned earlier, banks, too big to fail. Well, if that isn't about concentrated power, what else is it about? I mean, they now have, unlike, other players in the world, these banks now have an implicit guarantee in the form of a guarantor in the form of the U.S. government. I mean, who else on the world scene can compete with that? I think we're entering, unfortunately, a very scary era. And, one thing that is so striking to me, having spent so many years trying to understand how communism really worked, not how it thought it worked, not its ideology, but how it really worked in practice, the networks and institutional arrangements that people employed to make it, who were in the system, to make it work, because there were shortages and you had to get around them if you wanted to live anything but a marginal life. And if you were a factory manager under communism and you needed inputs in order to get your state-owned factory, to keep it up and running, you had to make deals with people around, because no one, and you had to have trust, and inside information was the key to getting anything done, because nothing happened according to the central plan. And that sounds quite similar today. I mean, we don't have state-owned companies, we've got these monopolies now that are reliant on state power. And that sounds very similar. And the deal is that everything is huge, and just a few inside players who are loyal to each other, who guard information for themselves, who brand this information for everyone else's consumption, so it's so easy for them to pull the wool over our eyes, are running the show.
Well, that's the similarity there that I certainly see in terms of Putin and his KGB cronies, you know, they refer to the new Russian government as KGB Incorporated, and Gazprom, as you mentioned, is a state monopoly, and nobody knows about pipeline politics more than Putin does, and what's good for Gazprom is good for Russia, just as in the days of General Motors, that was the phrase was coined, what's good for GM is good for America. So,
exactly.
And Putin has a coterie of guys who sort of regulate the oligarchs. And now you're saying we've got a kind of revolving door here between the oligarchies, the government sacks, as you call them, Goldman Sachs people that come in and out of Treasury, back to Goldman Sachs and back through the no longer revolving door, the open door.
Right, or so, as it's been called, the evolving door.
The evolving door. So I understand Putin understands power. What's in it for Kashkari and these guys? And we know Paulson's worth several hundred million, so he's already a part of the oligarchic gravy train. But
well, you know, I'm not inside their heads, obviously, and I can't, you know, I can't really speak to that. But I know that, you know, just from studying communism and communist and post-communist societies, I mean, these kinds of systems have a dynamic of their own. And once you're inside, I mean, who is your loyalty to, really? Is it to your friends that you've been working with at the companies you've been working with? I mean, is it to the people that you identify with, or which, you know, are the Wall Street people in this case, you know, the Wall Street people, but, I mean, you're a Wall Street, say, turned government person. So, you know, it's sort of easy to see how this happens. And, of course, you have to keep the information closely guarded because it's too scary to let any outsider, you know about it, because what's being faced is you know, the financial crisis is you know.
Right. So this is goes to the heart of how we are becoming less democratic and more plutocratic, because there's no direct representation of the people. The people in power don't feel any connection to the people out there, and the representatives who are supposed to represent people in the House and the Senate represent capital. So, you know.
Right, or they're completely unempowered, disenfranchised. I think we are in a much less democratic era, and the players that I've charted and the way that they operate, and I've, you know, you can sort of just lay out the characteristics, how they operate, these multiple and mutually reinforcing roles, for example, working in networks, not sharing information, guarding information, branding it for other people's consumption. I mean, this is straight out of the East European post-communist playbook, and I think that's why I can sort of understand it, because I spent many years charting those networks and trying to look at how they snaked in and out and through the state and the private, and how the players in their maneuverings bridged and the market and bureaucracy and blended them.
Mm-hmm.
And really in the process created a new kind of beast, and that's exactly what seems to me is going on here. We're creating new forms of governing in which state and private power are interdependent.
And blurred.
I
thank you so much for joining us here today, Dr. Waddell. We should do a follow-up, because this is a fascinating subject, and I don't think too many people have a handle on what you're saying. Again, I thank you for joining us, Janine Waddell, professor at George Mason University's School of Public Policy. She's also a senior research fellow at the New America Foundation, and she's the author of a new book, that's coming out in December, Shadow Elite, How the World's New Power Brokers Undermine Democracy, Government, and the Free Market. And I'm now speaking with Dave Leventhal, who is a communications director for the Nonpartisan Center for Responsive Politics. He was formerly a longtime award-winning political reporter for the Dallas Morning News, and he's working now for opensecrets.org. That's opensecrets, one word, .org. At the Center for Responsive Politics, where they examine the influence of money on elections and public policy. And this You came up with a list, I guess back in June, right, Dave, of who was getting money from the healthcare industries, big pharma. I'm looking for the list. Here it is here. Big pharma, health providers, hospitals, nursing homes. We'll call them the health sector in general. And then this list was updated, I think, in August, right?
Correct. And indeed, we put together a list that basically lists every single member of Congress and how much money that they have taken in during their careers, going back 20 years since we began tracking this. And what we found is that there are basically dozens and dozens of members of Congress who have taken in more than $1 million from the health sector. And the health sector includes everything from pharmaceutical companies, hospitals, nursing homes, doctors and nurses associations, pretty medical supplies, pretty much anything that you could think of that would fall under that big umbrella of health. So the bottom line is that as this issue has coursed through Congress, as it's been debated ad nauseum and still continues to be debated as it now moves into the Senate in earnest, we wanted to make sure that people, at the very least, were aware of the very, very significant amounts of money that have been flowing to these lawmakers who are making decisions that are going to very intimately affect the future and the business and the bottom line for the companies that have been bankrolling them all these years.
And the total in the last 20 years is, what, $140 million or something? Is it? I can't remember the total.
It's well above, it's into the tens and tens of millions of dollars.
Right. Well, on this list I have here, that the spreadsheet where you're starting with the biggest recipient of money, who is President Barack Obama. He's gotten $20 million from the health sector. John McCain $9 million. John Kerry $8.3 million. Now, they've all run for president, so that explains why they're way out in terms of money, right?
Of course. When you go and exclude them from the list, you still have a number who are in the $4 million, $3 million, $2
million. Oh, sure, sure. And, in fact, of the top 30 in the Senate, there's twice as many Democrats as there are Republicans.
Absolutely. And you know, campaign contributions are something where it's not like, you know, the boss tweet days where you can come up with a wad of cash, give that to a member of Congress and influence them in a moment's time. What we're trying to track is the longer view, to show that many members of Congress have had long-standing relationships with the industries that are now coming and, for most of them, lobbying the federal government to a very strong degree, spending hundreds of millions of dollars lobbying the federal government just this year alone. And we're trying to illustrate that in this other realm, the campaign finance realm, there are just dozens and dozens of members who do indeed have these long-standing relationships with the industries that want to make sure that they get their piece of flesh out of this healthcare bill.
Well, some of them that have skin in the game, as they say. you've got Max Baucus. He's the recipient of $3.88 million. He's important. Chuck Grassley, $2.6 million. Blanche Lincoln, who's wavering on the public option, over $2 million, and so on. I'm sort of amused to see at the bottom of the list, poor Senator the guy, Roland Burris. I guess they didn't think he was going to be around long enough to give him any money. But clearly, we're talking about 20 years worth of investment in these senators. And it's impossible not to assume that the people who invest in these politicians want something in return.
Well, certainly. If you are a company and you are trying to get a desired result from the federal government and you have money to do it, you're not going to put that limited amount of money in the hands of somebody who you don't think is going to be able to work with you or, to its extent, do your bidding or at least have your best corporate interest in mind when a decision is being made. And, of course, a number of things go into the way that a member of Congress will vote. This is just one factor among several or among many, but it's a very, very important factor. It's a very compelling factor. And if you have a great relationship with a certain industry, it's more than not unlikely then it's unlikely that you're going to just wantonly cut against their interests. At the very least, you're going to let them into your door. You are going to talk to them. You are going to work with them. You're going to hear them out. And they will have a certain degree of access to you that perhaps other industries that have been unfriendly to you as a congressman would not have.
Well, a couple of the senators on that six-panel backroom Senate deal where they came up with the bill that Baucus put forth and that Olympia Snowe was peeled away. She's only 750,000 here. She's a piker. Jeff Bingaman, 864,000. They're not up into the millions like the rest of them. As was, of course, the Max Baucus, the chair of the Senate Finance Committee, at 3.882 million. I guess the explanation for why twice as many Democrats are in the top 30 as Republicans would be what? That they're in power and that big money only wants to spend their money on the people that are in power that can do them favors and deliver?
And oftentimes we do see that with campaign contributions, that that may or may not be the overriding factor here. It definitely is, to some degree, and certainly recently, it's very much the case. But if you look at the way that industries actually give out their money, and this is something that we track very closely at the Center for Responsive Politics, it's very amusing sometimes to see who is in power and then cross that with the donation patterns of the company. Oftentimes we'll see the Republicans in power. When you look back 20 years, and the donations from a certain industry will be 70% to Republicans, 30% to Democrats. Then all of a sudden the Democrats take power. And then the numbers, if not completely flip, come very close to doing so. So the ultimate takeaway from that is that many industries, many companies are willing to sort of flap in the political winds and try to put their money where they feel they can get the most bang for their buck. The business of business is making money, and that's what they want to do. And when it comes to federal level type of regulations, when it comes to laws being passed, they want to make sure that those laws, those regulations, are going to be advantageous to them.
Well, that is the case with the health lobby. I mean, they've had a basically unfettered run at the trough. There's been little to no regulation, and that's why the healthcare costs in this country are running away and are at 16.5-17% of GDP compared to 9% in most of the other advanced industrial economies. So there's an attempt now going on to rein them in a little bit with these healthcare reforms and to make them live up to their promises in terms of delivering on their policies and not reneging and hanging people out to dry, et cetera, et cetera. But I, as I look at your list here, Dave Leventhal, I get the whiff of money, and I just think, you know, seriously, that bill barely got out of the House, 220 to 215, and it's going into the Senate, which is often referred to as the money house. Do you really think, I know it's maybe out of your purview, but do you think it has a chance of anything emerging here that resembles healthcare reform?
It would be very difficult for me to speculate, but let me show you this, and to step back just a moment and seize on your point about lobbying. That's really the other half of this equation here. And during the first three quarters of this year, so we're talking January 1st until September 30th, the health sector has spent nearly $400 million, let that sink in for a second, on federal lobbying efforts. So $400 million, what would that buy you? That would basically run a medium to large size U.S. city for an entire year. Police, fire, streets, water, take care of everything. And this is just the money coming from the health sector going just to the federal government. The pharmaceutical and health products industry alone has spent about half of that, nearly $200 million. And so many people always ask us, well, why would they spend so much money? Why would they be going through all this trouble and just emptying their pockets on lobbying efforts? And the answer is very simple. They have so much money and they have so much business that they're spending, so to speak, a dollar today so that ultimately they can save or earn $5 or $10 in the future by having a piece of legislation, by having a bill that is going to be in their corporate interests, that is going to benefit them. And you can't blame them. I mean, they have every right in the world to lobby. The First Amendment of the Constitution allows for people to petition their government for redress of grievances. That is lobbying at its core. But I don't think the Founding Fathers, to any degree, would have expected that the healthcare lobby in 2009 would be lobbying the federal government to the tune of $400 million. That's just the nature of the way that the game is being played today. That is the amount of money that's going in. And if you look at all lobbying of all sorts to the federal government this year, $2.5 billion, billion with a B. And that's a pretty sizable number. I bet a lot of people could do a lot of things with $2.5 billion.
Well, you know, I don't think there's any business where you get a better bang for your buck than buying politicians. I mean, for example, if you spend $1 million, if you're a big pharmaceutical company and you spend $1 million on a senator, a key senator, to slip into a bill an extension on a patent that you have on Viagra or some drug that's about to become a generic, and, you know, for $1 million, one or two words in a bill can result in billions of profit.
Without question. And if the companies that lobby, if the executives that give donations, if the political action committees that dole out money, if they didn't think that their investment was a wise one and wasn't going to bear fruit down the line, they wouldn't do it. The fact that they do it, and the fact that year in and year out and year after year after year, the numbers continue to go up in terms of the amount of money that they are spending, that should be pretty indicative of what's going on here, that they do see success, that they do see a return on their investment. Most people, if they had a stock investment that just kept going down and down and down, well, it would either go down to nothing or they would get rid of it. That's certainly not the case that we see here with lobbying expenditures, for sure, and arguably campaign contributions as well.
Again, I'm speaking with Dave Leventhal, who's a communications director for the Nonpartisan Center for Responsive Politics, which through its award-winning publicly accessible website, opensecrets.org, examines the influence of money on elections and in public policy. Now, let's turn to the spreadsheet here. We've done with the Senate into the House, and of course the bill's already gone out of the House, and as I say, it barely squeaked by. The top 30 recipients of money from the health sector, that's health insurance, pharmaceuticals, health providers, hospitals, and nursing homes, the top of the top 30, in this case, there are more Republicans, 18 Republicans and 13 Democrats, but the top three are all Democrats. Charles Rangel, himself somewhat ethically challenged at the moment. Frank Pallone from New Jersey, he's also on the take from what's called the Indian lobby. I'm not talking about Indian gaming, I'm talking about the country of India. And then you got Steny Hoyer, number three. There, you know, Rangel's $3.2 million, Pallone $2.8 million, and Hoyer $2.7 million. And then it goes on down to the bottom where Steve Rothman is getting $1 million. But so why then in the House, where the Republicans didn't even vote, not one, except that one guy down in Louisiana voted for the health care bill, the rest of them didn't vote against it, why would the health care lobby favor Republicans over Democrats, since they weren't going to vote at any rate?
Well, since we look back 20 years and take the long-term view on this, there's certainly a whole host of different health-related issues that have come before Congress over the past 20 years. So that's definitely one contributing factor to the amount of money that they've received from the healthcare sector. Another contributing factor is that they've been in office for a while, and over the past 20 years, most of them, they've had a better opportunity to build longer, deeper, more deep-seated relationships with the industries that make up the health sector. So at the end of the day, what you have, though, is you have in all of these House members some pretty powerful folks, people who are very influential, and although they may not, at the end of the day, vote the way that a certain industry would like them to or not, they definitely have a lot of influence, they definitely have pull, they definitely have the ability to, whether it be within their own party or even across party lines, mm-hmm. be people who will be listened to at the very least when they're speaking.
I thank you so much for joining us here today, Dale Leventhal, and for providing this information, which is, again, readily available online at opensecrets.org. You can get the entire spreadsheet of who in the House and Senate got what from whom. Again, Dave Leventhal, the Communications Director of the Nonpartisan Center for Responsive Politics. Thanks a lot, Dave. And now let's go to the subject of Sarah Palin. I'm speaking with Richard Kim, who's a senior editor at The Nation, where he writes about politics and culture. His essays and editorials have appeared in Salon, the San Francisco Chronicle, the Chicago Sun-Times, the Boston Herald, In These Times, Nerve, and Metro, and other publications. He's taught American Studies at Skidmore College and New York University. And together with Betsy Reed, the executive editor of The Nation, they've assembled Going Rouge, Sarah Palin, An American Nightmare, available online only through Orb Books. That's O-R-B, capital, OOKS.com. And obviously, this is a parody of Sarah Palin's book, Going Rogue, which I understand is a bestseller, even though it's not out yet.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's been number one or number two on Amazon for weeks, and they've printed 1.5 million copies. So it's definitely a bestseller, and I don't think we've seen the last of Sarah Palin. But just to clarify one thing, the cover and the title are parodies, but the contents of the book are actually rather serious, and they're a collection of essays, some old and some new for this book, that really examine her record and her behavior on the campaign trail and tell the other side of the whitewash that we know we're going to get from Sarah Palin's ghostwritten memoir, which drops on November 17th.
Indeed, many of the people here who've written essays for the compilation, Max Blumenthal, Jane Hampshire, Shannon Moore up there in Alaska, I've spoken to a number of times, Matt Taibbi, and you've also got my good friend Gloria Steinem in there. So
yep.
I guess my question to you, Richard, is, you know, we have a problem in this country where the right wing, the Republicans, aren't interested in facts and data, and the left wing, the Democrats, are consumed by them. So if you put out all of this intelligent stuff, don't expect anybody on the Republican side to read it.
No, but I actually hope some independents read it, and it's also great for the progressives and for the left to be armed with facts. We've seen the danger of Sarah Palin and what she can do in a fact-free universe. Look back at the whole death panel hysteria that consumed the whole month of August. You know, that's just a total lie. There's no such thing as a death panel in the healthcare bill. It's for optional end-of-life consultations. Palin herself actually supported some of those when she was governor of Alaska. But she really sort of derailed the whole debate for a month. And it's important for progressives to really know where she stands on issues, where she stands on abortion, where she stands on the environment, and where she stands actually on healthcare when it comes to her actual positions and the damage she can continue to do even though she's out of office.
Well, indeed, there was a piece by Paul Krugman in the New York Times, I think it was yesterday or perhaps today, where he warned that we're misreading the results of the election up in upstate New York,
right.
Where the conservative came in with Palin and Limbaugh support and nevertheless lost, canceled out the Republican, and then the Democrat won a solidly Republican seat for the first time in 100-plus years. He warned that we're taking the wrong lesson from that, that what could happen is that the Republican Party under Palin, Limbaugh, and Beck, who are nominally the face of the new party, will end up being a powerful force, even if they're a minority force, and the nation will go the way of California, where you have a small, zealous group, a minority, that's able to frustrate and veto everything. And even though here in the state of California, it's a predominantly Democratic state, you could argue that for the last several decades, with the help of Republican governors, the Republicans have controlled this state through the minority in the Assembly and the Senate.
Right. You know, I think Paul is right there. There's certainly a kind of glee that Democrats get from watching Sarah Palin, Sarah Barracuda, as she sort of cannibalizes what's left of the Republican Party. And because of her intervention in the 23rd District in New York, you know, that seat went Democrat. It hasn't been Democrat since the 19th century. So when we look ahead at what she might do in 2010, targeting moderates like Florida's Charlie Crist in his bid to become a senator from Florida, or a bid for the 2012 presidency, there's a certain aspect of, all right, bring it on. I mean, you know, her poll numbers, her support amongst all voters is at a 33% low. you know, that's like practically a guarantee for an Obama second term and supermajorities for Democrats in the Congress. On the other hand, you know, I think Krugman is right that there is a danger to her, not so much electorally. I don't see how she's going to put together a winning coalition to win a national election. But she could certainly torpedo the Democratic process. And that's the way the whole Republican Party has been, really, since Obama has been elected, the party of no. And Sarah is at the head of that. And, you know, we've seen, you know, this whole health care bill, for example, it's looking like it's going to take past this is the winter recess. And that's dangerous territory for the Democratic majority. She's going to be taking to Facebook again to talk about death panels and taking away American freedom. So, you know, she definitely can exert a malign influence, even though she's out of power.
Again, I'm speaking with Richard Kim, who is a senior editor of The Nation, where together with Betsy Reed, the executive editor of The Nation, they have assembled Going Rouge, Sarah Palin, An American Nightmare, available online through orbbooks.com. But there's no two B's in there. I'm trying to...
No, there's just one B, yes, okay. Orbbooks.com.
You know, I'm trying to help you here.
Thank you.
Sell books. Now, the thing is that what I find extraordinary about Sarah Palin, not so much her, it's the cynicism of these besotted male conservatives from the Weekly Standard, Bill Kristol, Fred Barnes, and Bush's born-again speechwriter, Michael Gerson, and Dick Morris, the toe-sucking political hireling that Clinton had the bad judgment to hire and who's now a regular fixture on Fox News. All of these people championed her. Now, Bill Kristol and the neocons also championed, well, we can get back to Dan Quayle, but certainly George W. Bush. And one of the things they said in print that they liked about George Bush was that he was an empty suit and that they could fill his head with all kinds of ideas, like let's invade Iraq. We've lived through that catastrophe. So this woman, in spite of all that you say about her, is simply just another blank sheet of paper for the neocons to try and catapult into national office.
You know, I would agree that in part. I mean, Sarah Palin is definitely more surface appeal than substance. When she was governor of Alaska, she sort of shifted in the wind, and she certainly has very solid conservative values. She's against abortion, you know, she's drill, baby, drill. But she also did, as governor, sort of stand up to the oil companies and turn over some of the money from taxing them to Alaska citizens. She was sort of the Hugo Chavez of the Arctic Circle, if you will. So she is, you know, she sort of shifts where the wind goes, but we've also seen through her behavior during the campaign that she can, in fact, go rogue. And that's where actually the term comes from, that McCain aides coined that, that she had gone off script and off message and really sort of more consumed with her own status and her own sort of celebrity appeal than even the sort of life of the Republican Party or the McCain-Palin candidacy. So that's a dangerous situation for the so-called maestros of the Republican Party to engage in. They should really think twice about the deal they're making with Sarah Palin.
Well, she obviously likes the idea of going rogue because that's the title of her book. But I don't think that Kristol and company probably care. They like the idea, I think, that she's stirring up the base, that she's got all of these Berthas and Birches and teabaggers all riled up along with Limbaugh and Beck, and I think they love that stuff. I mean, that's how that's always been their MO. It's like
right.
You know, the industrialists in Germany in the 30s thought that Hitler was kind of a crazy guy, but he kept the unions in you know under in line, and you know, let's go with him because he'll further our agenda.
Right,
I don't think
right.
they care, do they? I mean. This is not about ideology. This is about power.
Well, it depends on who you talk to. So as a way to sort of stymie Obama and you know sort of really roll back any efforts by the Democrats to pass reform measures, yes, the sort of crazy, zany right-wing populism is useful. I still don't see how they're going to get more than 50% or 45% really in any national election behind someone like Palin, even backed by Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh. So the sort of saner heads in the Republican Party, those that have conservative values but also want to win national elections, a lot of them have repudiated Sarah Palin, including McCain's former campaign manager, Steve Schmidt, who has said that the 2012 Palin candidacy would be a disaster for the Republican Party. So that's my question I have for these, you know, right-wing ideologues. How exactly do you think you're going to win and then govern under President Palin.
Well, as Steve Schmidt said that, but McCain himself said something quite different, didn't he?
That's absolutely right. I think it's sort of Palin's party now, actually, and McCain did say that she's a formidable candidate, and she ranks right up there with Mitt Romney and Mike Huckabee as leading contenders for 2012. But, you know, even in that statement, McCain, I think, was making more statement of fact. She is formidable, and she does rank up there, rather than an endorsement of Palin outright. It'd be interesting to see how this all shakes out between the sort of Republican Party establishment and Sarah Palin and, you know, Tim Pawlenty, Mitt Romney, Mike Huckabee, and all these folks in the next few years.
I wouldn't say I'm taking a bet here, but at least I'm bringing up the possibility, Richard Kim, that she could be more dangerous than liberals who laugh her off may live to regret. One, the economy is falling deeper into the toilet, and there's just it seems inexorable that since we've rescued Wall Street and we can't, there's no money left to rescue Main Street. And there's no way that anybody has the political courage to push forward another stimulus. So, the economy's going to twist in the wind. Already, the right-wing people that have been stirred up by Palin have captured, of all things, anti-Wall Street populism, which the Democrats seem to be afraid to grasp, even though, you know, the right-wing support the very people who brought about the problem in the first place, that to the brink of an economic collapse, and have policies that would actually make this place more of a third-world country and make the plutocrats stronger and the workers weaker. But for some reason or other, the Democrats and the left are absent in this argument. They're not seizing on this anti-Wall Street populism, even though Corzine got wiped out and Bloomberg almost did by that very backlash. So the Dems are asleep at the switch, and the angry people are going to show up. So I wouldn't count her out.
Yeah, no, I agree with you about the dangers that lie ahead. And unless the Democrats get a spine and actually make good on some of the promises, the sort of populist rage that she stirs up is always a danger. I just think it's a danger right now is actually in the sort of disruption of the democratic process that it foments, rather than any sort of very clear electoral strategy. But, you know, you could be right, too. And it's a long, long road to 2010 and 2012, and she's certainly out there, increasing her brand, intervening in elections where she's not even asked to. She actually made robocalls in the Republican Virginia gubernatorial race, in the gubernatorial race in Virginia for the Republican, that he didn't know about and didn't ask for. So she's clearly, you know, intervening in these races with an eye to being a player.
Well, it sort of reminds me of the expression of Somerset Maugham's, that the great comfort to the mediocre is that they're always at their best. And this is a woman who really doesn't understand her limitations. But the people who support her also don't understand her limitations. And in fact, they celebrate her lack of intelligence, knowledge, and understanding. There's a virtue in ignorance, that awash in the land. So again,
that's absolutely true. And also, the other thing that enables is that whenever she is attacked for her lack of knowledge, when she just doesn't even know what the Bush Doctrine is, regurgitates nouns without any verbs in between them, they say that she's being unfairly judged because she's a woman and that there's media sexism against her or a double standard. So, you know, she's certainly a sort of package there that is armed and dangerous.
Well, we've certainly come a long way from the founding fathers who only wanted white men of property to vote. And the notion was that you voted for people, for extraordinary people like Jefferson and Washington and Adams, you know, that ordinary people voted for extraordinary people. Now, the ordinary people are celebrating ordinary people. And I suppose, you know, it sounds elitist to be critical of that. But that's welcome to, brain dead America.
Yeah, I mean, she certainly, but look, the other thing is that the country did reject her.
Sorry, they rejected McCain. I'm not sure they rejected her.
Well, and
she certainly didn't think
she
did. She wanted to have a concession speech, you know.
She did, and McCain said no. But I do think that her high moment was the Republican National Convention. And, you know, she sort of trotted out there with the hockey mom speech, which was a great speech, and she performed really well in that moment. Nobody knew anything about her record, and nobody had really seen her talk off script. The more the election happened, and certainly the economic crisis played into Barack Obama's win there also. But the more they heard her speak and reveal really the lack of very basic information she has, I think they were turned off by her. And what looked like an asset, you know, in September 1st, I think became a deficit by the time the election was over.
So what about, Richard Kim, the possibility of more kind of grist for the National Enquirer coming out of Dogpatch, Alaska? Well, you've already got the first dude being pursued by Greta Van Susteren, who's madly in love with him.
Right.
And you've got the son-in-law who's, you know, doing naked spreads in Playgirl or something and talking about that he's got all kinds of dark secrets that he's holding against Sarah Palin. So any shoes to drop there?
Not really in the book. There's certainly more that's going to drop. You know, I think in some ways, she, at least amongst her fans and the base, none of this really matters. It sort of endears, you know, America more to her, or her version of America more to her. You know, she's been able to trade in a kind of political power for a kind of celebrity power and a media power. How that's actually going to work going forward is a tricky one. You know, she's beholden to no constituency now, so in a way that liberates her to say really, you know, crazy things and to stoke conspiracy theories. But, you know, that might actually come back to bite her as she tries to actually reinsert herself into the political process and suggest that she actually has the capacity to govern the country.
Well, obviously she'd be better off taking a job at Fox News as a host. That's the perfect position for her. But she clearly has ambitions to be president of the United States. At least that's the way it seems. Just in closing, though, Richard Kim, one of the essays is about the new Christian sexual politics, which I find fascinating. Because people assume that good Christians don't have sex, and I believe that they do. At least there's a rumor to that effect. And that Palin is sort of, and her family are exemplars of the new Christian sexual politics: married, fertile, God-fearing, and hot.
Right. Yeah, you know, conservatives really celebrated her sex appeal, and they even celebrated, you know, Bristol's pregnancy. She was an unwed mother, clearly a sort of failure of abstinence-only education. But that actually didn't pose any contradictions for them, because for many years, actually, they'd sort of backed off on the kind of prudery that we associate with the sort of traditional conservative. And, you know, their Christian marital sex aid books, you know, lots of websites talk about how to, you know, be better in bed and be a great Christian mother. And she definitely was, you know, a hot mama, as many conservative websites called her. So there's nothing really sort of new about that. It's just that she really brought it to the national, you know, forefront.
Okay, well, I'm waiting for the Democratic centerfold. I thank you so much for joining us here today, Richard Kim.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. And hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking then with Richard Kim. He's a senior editor at The Nation, who, together with Betsy Reed, the executive editor of The Nation, have assembled Going Rouge, Sarah Palin, An American Nightmare, which is available online through orbbooks.com. That's orbbooks.com. I thank the executive producer, Louis Vandenberg, Janie Coolidge, the associate producer, Elliot Fong, the associate producer, Anthony Castillo, the assistant producer, and Giovanni Solis, the assistant producer, and Ray Palias, the engineer. I'll be back again tomorrow for another daily briefing at 5 p.m. here at KPFK. So have a very pleasant evening, and I'll talk to you tomorrow. Bye.
In Studio City, Cindy Asner, Susan Clark, Elizabeth Forsyth Haley, Catherine Lincoln, Betsy Folds-Maiman, and Bioneer San Fernando Valley mark Veterans Day with an evening with Blaise Von Payne, Guerrilla of Peace, Office of the Americas Director, and KPFK program host. He will discuss his activist life. That's Wednesday at 7 p.m. in the Parish Hall of St. Michael and All Angels Church. Call 818-907-9260.
In Ventura, journalist Dar Jamel gives up-to-the-minute reporting and shares his hard